Welcome to Shattering Myths, a lone voice crying out in the wilderness. A program that is devoted to those whose ears are open, whose eyes are open, whose minds are open, and who have come to realize after exercising good judgment that all of the world's religious institutions are corrupt, that they're counterproductive, that they're rotten to the core, as are every one of the world's political institutions, its economic institutions, its media institutions. And this program is even devoted to those of you who still cling to the notion that the military provides a service, that they are beneficial, that they are worthy of your devotion and praise. Because even there, the truth will ultimately prevail if your eyes, ears, and mind are open, and if you're willing to exercise good judgment, if you're able to be discriminating, to be discerning. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, if you'd like to challenge anything that I have to say, feel free to do so. Scott, the host of our program, will pay for the call. It is 877-300-7645. I want to begin in a place that is distant from the most compelling news of the day, but it continues to affirm something that I have shared for some time. There is a serious problem, not only with the pilot training and decision-making in the Muslim world, but also with the judgment being exercised by the European consortium building the Airbus airplane. The first Airbus that crashed as a result of a shear of the bolt holding its rudder in place occurred in the New York area. I think he was departing JFK, where a pilot, following noise abatement procedures, turned the rudder hard in one direction, and the bolt sheared. The airplane lost its vertical stabilizer, and it crashed, killing everybody on board. Then you have the Airbus that was flying over the Atlantic, having crossed the Brazilian coast, entered an area of unstable air. The pilot overreacted, exercised too much control over the rudder. The rudder bolt shattered, and the first thing they found of the wreckage was the tail, wholly intact, but completely distant from the rest of the airplane. Now they have found the tail of the Airbus A320 that crashed on Air Asia. And while the pilots made every possible bad decision that you can make, they did not study the weather before departure. It wasn't even a requirement of the airlines, which is just insane. And they requested higher altitude because of approaching weather as opposed to a course variation. And that they then attempted a very steep climb and stalled the airplane. All of those things we know. But beyond that, the fact is that now the tail, completely intact, has been found of the airplane. The tail is immediately over the place where all radar contact with the airplane was lost, and it is a significant distance from the rest of the wreckage. Once again, the tail sheared off. Now, the issue here is that the difference between a Boeing commercial jet and an Airbus is the metallurgy of the principal bolts that hold the vertical stabilizer in place, the tail section of the airplane. The tail section of the airplane is disjoined from the rest of the aircraft. It has a 0% chance of surviving. It becomes aerodynamically unstable and horrific directional forces are placed upon the aircraft. The G-forces will cause it to disintegrate ultimately. It cannot be flown. And in this particular case, the Europeans choose to use normal, available metallurgy to make the bolt. And Boeing purchased a rare earth element indirectly from the Chinese to craft the bolt that holds that rudder in place. We have not had a single incident of a Boeing commercial aircraft losing its vertical stabilizer, and we've had many now with the Airbus. I received an email this morning. It reads as follows. It's from one of my favorite people, the gentleman that was for many years the administrator of the Yada Ya Forum. If you listen to this program, haven't participated in the Yada Ya Forum, go to yadaya.com. You'll see a forum link in the upper right. Click on it. Your participation is completely anonymous. It's totally free. You can read prior posts. You can post questions yourselves. You can interact with the participants. I would encourage you to do so. But the gentleman that was the administrator of the Yada Ya Forum for many years, and then the man that cajoled me into doing a radio program, actually set up the Blog Talk radio program, encouraged me to, it's kind of funny, it's a long story, but to participate in it many years ago. He sent me this email. He listens to the program regularly. I particularly likes the commentary on the news and our review of the Torah. He said, I don't know if you've watched much of the coverage on CNN. It's sickening. I have watched coverage on a number of news networks, and it's repulsive. It's nauseating. I would agree. He says, I'm paraphrasing here, but one reporter actually asked, speaking of Charlie Hebdo publishing a cartoon depicting Muhammad both as the inspiration for terror, enemy of free speech, and also as a sexual pervert, which would be the three most compelling aspects of Muhammad's life, accurately portrayed as a sexual pervert, naked, and we'll go into that in a moment. As a gentleman inspiring terrorism, and we'll go into that in a moment, as well as someone who was hostily, violently opposed to free speech, and we'll consider that too. That's how they depicted Muhammad. He said, isn't it like yelling fire in a crowded theater? You don't do it because people can get hurt. Shouldn't they have been more careful before releasing those satirical cartoons when they knew that Muslims would be offended? You know, I'm glad there is a place that most people refer to as hell. I'm glad there's a place called Sheol. Now, I'm glad that most people don't go there. I'm glad that God didn't say, love me, accept my way, or I'm going to see to it that you're tortured forever for hell. Such a God would be sadistic, and that's not the case. That's the Christian and Muslim mythos regarding heaven and hell is completely and utterly erroneous. But there is such a place. It's called Sheol, and it is for idiots like this person speaking on behalf of CNN that would value not offending people much higher than confronting a ruthless, sexually perverted, demonic, deadly, destructive dogma. That they would put not offending people way ahead of the truth, way ahead of protecting innocent people from a vicious, vicious cult. Those kind of people deserve eternal torment for what they have done. I don't know if this was a man or a woman who said this, but I am comforted to know there is a consequence for aiding and abetting mass murderers, excusing the behavior of mass murderers and blaming mass murder on the victims. Hell is a fine abode for such people. I want to share with you another person that knows a thing or two about this, but actually spoke intelligently in response to yesterday's shooting at the French magazine Charlie Hebdo. Salman Rushdie released a statement defending the art of comedic criticism. He says, "I stand with Charlie Hebdo, as we all must, except, of course, the reporter for CNN, to defend the art of satire, which has always been a force for liberty and a force against tyranny, a force against dishonesty, a force against stupidity. When it comes to Islam, tyranny, dishonesty, and stupidity describe the religion. It is the dumbest religion ever conceived by humankind. The Quran is the most dishonest and foolish books ever written. Everything Islam touches is subject to its tyranny." Now, if you look at satirical humor, why don't you look at the early American humor? You know, when Americans were considering, and it was a minority of Americans that were considering a revolution against the British because they didn't like paying taxes to the British king, they used satirical comics to depict the king in a demeaning way. Satirical comments have always been common. If you look at America's leftist newspapers, and most newspapers in America are exceedingly liberal, and I don't have a dog in this hunt. I'm not liberal. I'm not conservative. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I despise both parties and any political movement. But I can tell you with great regularity, even today, the caricatures of conservatives by the liberal media in cartoons are repulsive. They're really disgusting. They're, in almost all cases, they're based on lies, they're based on deceptions, they're based on distortions, and they're reprehensible. No one seems to complain. They don't run out and start a jihad. They don't run into the offices of the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, and commit acts of mass murder. Well, I disagree with the accuracy and the depictions in those comments and those comics. I'm not enraged by them. It's true. The art of satire, which is an intelligent approach to exposing and condemning. To use satire, even to use almost any form of sophisticated humor, requires intelligence. Now, I'm going to tell you that I think that the leftist cartoons depicting the those that they oppose on the right are most always inappropriate. They're extrapolating something that is actually unrelated to or in opposition to the point they're trying to make. But the visual imageries are still strong. It's a very effective tool, even when wielded out of a base of opinion as opposed to fact. And it is a tool that has been used to expose all forms of tyranny. And there is no more tyrannical regime on the planet today than Islam. For a number of years, as we began this century, particularly as we approached the second decade of this century, the most ruthless form of tyranny, actually the third decade of this century, this past century, was communism. And the communist regimes, the socialist regimes in Nazi Germany and Russia and in China were the most tyrannical on earth, most deadly on earth. And to a significant degree, there was some cartoons and other attempts at humor to disparage them. Now, the fact is, because communism and because socialism are liberal, there weren't as many of them in the media. And lots of, even though it was socialist, it was the German Socialist Workers' Party, Nazis. The fact that they were the National German Socialist Workers' Party, there's such a fine line between socialism and fascism that distinction was exaggerated in favor of fascism. And so the media did have a field day using satire to expose Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, exposing a tyranny. They weren't as prone to do so with Stalin or with Mao Zedong. But today, the ultimate tyranny, if you look at the Islamic world, is Islam. And there is no more dishonest dogma. I mean, Islam is literally the antithesis of what's true. Christianity is a counterfeit of what's true. Islam is the antithesis. It's completely and totally dishonest. The Islam is so dishonest, Muhammad himself admits that he lies. He even says that Allah lies. And you've got to be stupid to be a Muslim. You know, to believe that Allah wants you to kill innocent people for him, and that if you kill innocent people, he's going to reward you with multiple virgins in paradise, you've got to be stupid. And you've just got to be absolutely out of your mind stupid. So Rushdie's words were particularly relevant, given that his own work, a magical realist novel inspired by Muhammad's life, led the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini to issue a fatwa against him in 1989. His 2013 memoir, Joseph Anton, further promotes the right to offend. You know, Satanic Verses was not offensive. It really wasn't. No. Satanic Verses are talked about in the Quran. If you're a Muslim, read your damn Quran. Pick it up, read it. And if you want to understand the Satanic Verses, then you've got to read the Hadith. And you need to realize that this notion that the Hadith aren't all true and that the Quran is the only true book, it's absolute rubbish. And you need to be smart enough to recognize that the Quran is Hadith. It's an oral report from Muhammad and his companions, passed on orally, generation to generation for over 100 years before it was written down. And the Hadith came from the same exact person, conveyed exactly the same way, at exactly the same time, talking about exactly the same circumstance. There is no difference between Hadith and Quran. The Quran is Hadith. It's an oral report from Muhammad and his companions. And that without the Hadith, there is no Islam. Literally, Islam vanishes. It ceases to exist as a religion without the Hadith. The Quran cannot be followed. It cannot be understood without the Hadith. So if you want to understand Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses, read what the Quran and Hadith have to say about them. It's a fascinating tale, and we're going to cover that tale, as well as engage in conversation with Glenn when Shattering Myth continues after the commercial break. There are a lot of reasons to recognize that Islam is dishonest and that Islam is foolish, stupid, to use Salman Rushdie's words, and that you'd have to be an absolute idiot to kill, much less sacrifice your life for the idiocy of Islam. But the Satanic Verses are as good as any. They can't be denied because they are confirmed in the Quran. The Quran says that all of Allah's messengers speak on behalf of Satan. And it's true, because Allah was modeled after Satan. Allah really is Muhammad. Which is why Muslims have a conniption fit about drawing Muhammad, because it's obvious. Anybody that reads the Quran and thinks about the voice of the Quran, the style of the Quran, the situation being justified by the Quran. I mean, it's everything in Muhammad's life that is being justified in the Quran, that it becomes obvious. I mean, you don't have to be all that smart to recognize that the voice of the Quran really is Muhammad. And that Allah is Muhammad. And so Muslims don't want Muhammad depicted, because it becomes ever clearer that the voice of the Quran is Muhammad. And beyond that, Muhammad was, according to the Quran and Hadith, reprehensible. He was a mass murderer. He was a ruthless terrorist. He was a pedophile. He was a rapist. He was incestuous. He was an avowed liar. He was a slave trader. He was a kidnapper. He was repulsive. That's why Sharia law is so repulsive. Sexual pervert and sadist. I mean, it'd be hard to find a more repulsive figure in world history than Muhammad. And so they don't want him depicted. It's, you focus on who Muhammad was as an individual, and you would be an absolute idiot to be a Muslim. But the Satanic Verse is really a simple story. The Quraysh, and this is documented in the first like 80 surahs of the Quran chronologically, not numerically, because the Quran is a jumbled mess, completely without context or without chronology. But with the Hadith, you can reorder the Quran chronologically, and when you do, you find that the first 80 surahs are all about those who knew Muhammad best, saying that he was an idiot, that he was a liar, that he was faking it, that he was demon-possessed, that he was simply seeking sex, power, and money, and he was in it for personal gain, and that everything he said was nonsensical. And so they said as much to him, and the Quran is filled with their testimony that those who knew Muhammad best, who heard Muhammad's claims to be Allah's messenger, mocked him, as would any informed and sensible person today. They did the exact same thing that Charlie Hebdo did with the cartoons. They mocked him. And so what they finally did, because the other half of those first 80 surahs is all about Muhammad's lashing back at them by having his God say that those who mock Muhammad will get a painful torment in hell, and then it describes the tortures that Allah will perpetrate on those who knew Muhammad best in hell, making them drink molten pitch, ripping off their skins slowly, giving them a new skin so Allah could have fun ripping off their skin again. That's the kind of thing that the Quran describes as the torments in hell. Now, if you have a God that's going to spend time in hell torturing people, my guess is you may want to find, just as a suggestion, Muslims, you may want to find a different God than Allah. That's pretty despicable. So, the Quraysh finally said, this guy's not willing to go away enough already. I'll tell you what, we'll try a different tactic with them. And what the Quraysh did is they got together. That was the tribe that Muhammad belonged to. It was the prominent tribe in the little mud hut village of Mecca. They said, I'll tell you what, Muhammad, we know what you're all about. You want sex, power, and money. We'll give you money. We'll give you the prettiest girls in town, and you can be king for a day. We'll make you king of Mecca for a day. You can share authority over the town with the others and the Quraysh. We'll give you exactly what you want, sex, power, and money. All we need for you to do is, rather than, because at the time Muhammad was honoring Ar-Rahman, which was a Yemenite deity, pagan Hanifs down in Yemen, and he was actually citing Hanif poetry and calling it part of his Quran, that Muhammad, they asked Muhammad, why don't you incorporate the other gods of the Kaaba, Allah, and the three other principal goddesses of the Kaaba, Al-Uzza, Manat, for example, include them in your religion so that our Kaaba, which was really the only economic thing that the mud hut town of Mecca had going for it, the pagans would come to the rock pile that was the Kaaba and pay homage to the rock gods there. The same Kaaba, by the way, that is now the focal point of Islam in Mecca that millions of Meccans circumambulate. It was a pagan shrine to rock gods. There were 360 rock gods there. And Manat and Al-Uzza and Allah were rock gods there, but they were in competition with Ar-Rahman, the rock god of the Hanifs down in Yemen. So the Meccans said, include our gods and goddesses into your religion, and it keeps the Kaaba relevant, and we'll give you these things. And so Muhammad did. He has a Quran surah that talks about Al-Uzza and Manat, and says, they are our goddesses that are intermediaries to God. And So then Abu Bakr, who was the his principal benefactor and the supplier of his sex toy, Aisha, the six-year-old girl that Muhammad molested, that Abu Bakr says, wait a minute. You know, you've been telling us this is a monotheistic religion for your own personal gain and sex, power, and money. You now are willing to, and you have a Quran revelation that says that these Kaaba goddesses are divine. You now got five gods, Ar-Rahman, Allah, Manat, Al-Uzza, et al., at part of your religion. This is not a monotheistic religion anymore. And you did it for personal gain. Muhammad, come on. You know, I'm going to take my daughter away from you as a plaything. And so Muhammad recanted, and he says that statement was put into the Quran and became part of the Quran because Satan inspired it. And so the statements in the Quran honoring the Kaaba's goddesses became known as the satanic verses because Muhammad in the Quran acknowledged that he was inspired by Satan. So you would think that realization, and it's in the Quran, I mean, read the book, and it's explained in the Hadith, read it, would be enough to cause Muslims to give up their religion. We've got Glenn in Philadelphia and Jason in Toronto. First, Glenn, what do you think?
Well, you know, I'm thinking Yahweh, when he decided it was necessary to kill most of humanity except for eight people and flood a significant portion of the earth, created the flood himself. And when he decided it was necessary to kill off an Egyptian army pursuing the Israelites, he split the Red Sea and then made the waters flowing on them himself. So Yahweh has been known to do some of his own wet work, and in these cases it was very wet work. Does Allah ever do any of his own wet work, or does he just have psychotic henchmen do it all for him?
Allah's completely impotent. I mean, Allah takes credit. If you read the 8th Surah, Allah, you know, he had his henchmen, Allah is Muhammad. Muhammad had his henchmen carry out the raid and then attributed the throwing of the spears, the flinging of the arrows, the slicing of the knives, and the robbing to Allah. I mean, so Allah takes credit for the work of Muhammad and his goons. The same thing is true with the beheading of 900 men and boys with the Kareza tribe, and then the systematic enslavement of little girls as sex slaves. After the event, after Muhammad's goons did that, you've got Allah taking credit for it. Now, it's interesting. It should be noted too that as it relates to the flood, Yahweh did not destroy all Homo sapiens. He only eliminated Homo sapiens with an Asalma. When he says that specifically, an Asalma is a conscience, different from a consciousness, the soul. All animals have a soul. That is our consciousness. That's our ability to be observant and to respond to that which we observe. That's a soul or consciousness that differentiates animals from plants. And then he gave Adam through Adam Chawa a conscience, which is the ability to be discerning, to exercise good judgment, to differentiate between right and wrong. That's called a nesalma. And Yahweh only eliminated humans with a nesalma, which would be in the area from really Ur of the Chaldeans or Babylon, the southern city on the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates River, all the way up through the Black Sea, which is where Adam and Chawa left the Garden of Eden. That was under Lake Van, and that's where they migrated, was along the Tigris and Euphrates River, and that's where the flood occurred. It occurred no place else. So now there were a lot of water came down because the flood was started by the Burkle asteroid impact, so there's a lot of consequence around the world in terms of flooding, but not to eliminate humankind. Now, The and Yahweh did it for a reason. He realized that by being discriminating, by being able to outthink other animals, humankind had created religions, and he described them. He says, you know, you're so violent, you are so repulsive, that if I don't start again with a fresh start with eight people that have a Nesama that are that know me and are reasonable and their approach, if I don't start over again, the whole human experience will be for naught. Mankind won't even survive it. And that's why he did it. But he did it on his own. You're right. And the Egyptian army, he didn't go in and say, you know what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to go and wipe out the Egyptian army because it'd be fun. The Egyptian army, after letting his people go, were pursuing them, trying to kill them, and he protected his children like any loving father would do. But there's also another aspect of Yahweh beyond the fact that he actually acts on his own and does what he needs to be done on his own, and that is he's the source of life. So if the source of life truncates a life, he hasn't taken anything from anybody. You know, if
Yahweh giveth and Yahweh taketh away, blessed be the name of Yahweh.
Which is, it is his. We lost Jason over the break. I would have loved to hear what he had to say, calling in from Toronto. We realized that in Toronto, in Canada, they had a Muslim who attacked their parliament. And, of course, the first thing that everybody said is they disassociated the event from Islam. The Islamic State, of course, kidnaps little girls and turns them into sex slaves and beheads people from all over the world. And we first thing we find our politicians and our media doing is disassociating the Islamic State from Islam. Boko Haram goes off and kidnaps little girls, turns boys into killers, and turns the girls into sex toys. And the first thing that we find politicians around the world doing is disassociating them from Islam. Al-Nusra Front became the principal tool to be wielded at the government of Assad in Syria. And the first thing we found all politicians doing was trying to differentiate the motives of the Al-Nusra Front from Islam. The government of Iraq is a Shia government ruled entirely by the mullahs in Tehran, and they have their religious militias that we fought when we invaded Iraq, but now we have moved to wholly disassociate those religious militias from Islam and are in fact trying to associate them with a political entity in the government of Iraq. America aided and abetted the awakening program in Iraq. It became the Islamic State, and during the time that we were providing them with weapons, we wholly differentiated the awakening program Sunni tribesmen from the religion of Islam. Hamas will attack Israel with rockets, and the PLO will, Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, will organize and celebrate the kidnap and murder of Israeli children. And we, as a world, politically, in the media, religiously, do everything we can to disassociate their activities from the religion of Islam. Well, you know, the fact is that there's a reason that the Muslims are particularly irritated when Muhammad is depicted. Because anybody with their eyes open, with half a brain, realizes that the link between all of these horrific behaviors, the sex trade, kidnapping, enslavement, decapitating, terrorism, that the common denominator here is they're all behaviors that Muhammad himself did, that Muhammad glorified in the Quran and Hadith, that Muhammad inspired and authorized. And so when Muhammad is depicted, then there's a connection. Muhammad was a terrorist. Muhammad was a perverted rapist and pedophile. Muhammad was a thief, a kidnapper, a mass murderer. And so that's the reason why Muslims are offended when images of Muhammad are shown. Glenn, yesterday, or the day, I think it was yesterday, you said that you thought that this might be a Torah moment where that the sleeping giant might be awakened to the truth, since these Islamic jihadists all shouted Allahu Akbar and told those that they didn't kill to become, to convert to Islam and to study the Quran, were their instructions as they were killing, that this would be impossible to deny, and this might be the awakening. And yet, universally, every media institution in this country, as well as around the world, every politician of note, has gone out of their way to disassociate these Muslims from their religion. So how do we deal with
that? Well, I would suggest that maybe the giant isn't sitting bolt upright suddenly in bed, but that is waking. And I would suggest that, okay, yes, the media has, but you know, the media doesn't necessarily represent the masses. And I would suggest that there are probably a great many people who are putting two and two together on this, and you know, at least internally within themselves, you know, becoming less denial-oriented and aware that, you know, there seems to be some connection here, that all these attacks seem to be perpetrated by Muslims. So I think maybe there's at least some realization occurring, you know.
When you have 99% of the world's terrorist acts being perpetrated by Muslims screaming Allahu Akbar, you would think that by this time, everyone would have been able to make the connection. It's the most obvious connection in the world today. We'll be back.